The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Lockdown Episode 5. I'm in my house, Barry Glendenning in his house. There you are, Barry. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Yes, hanging in there. Slowly unravelling, but still reasonably compos mentis.
This is the first day in about 7 that I've actually put trousers on. I mean, that's mainly due to the weather, I would say, but I feel like it's an important step.
I don't want to be one of those people who really lets themselves go and doesn't shower, doesn't get dressed in the morning. So I'm wearing shorts, a t-shirt and an ill-matching shirt, but at least I've made the effort to get dressed and I'm still looking after my personal hygiene. I would love a haircut, though. I would love a haircut more than I would love a nice afternoon in a pub beer garden.
As I said to you yesterday, by the end of this, we may come out looking like Art Garfunkel and Art Garfunkel. I'm so grey. I get greyer. As it gets longer, it gets greyer. Question from Lee, Barry. Is it Monday or Thursday? My Guardian Football Weekly internal clock is a little bit off.
Very much Monday, all day today.
Yes.
Unless you're listening on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Fergus says, without football actually taking place, it is fair to say it's not worth listening to Football Weekly, but it's equally unmissable. And on a similar line, Shiro Atama says, I can't tell if the pod is too long or too short anymore. It is too long for my 5-second commute from the dining room to my desk and too short to fill up the other 23 hours, 59 minutes and 55 seconds I have to kill each day.
Yeah, well, I remember some years ago, people used to complain that it wasn't long enough, and that was, you know, it was over an hour. And I think some egg-headed boffins with clipboards figured out that the optimum time for a podcast is about 45 minutes. Now, I think if it's good, I'll happily listen to one for, say, 90, but I think anything over that's a bit too long.
Well, should we stick to 45 then on that on that barometer?
It very much depends on whether or not we're going to have a fit back corner, because the current mess in Scotland could take me a good hour to try and unravel.
This is from Joe, says Gangster's Paradise will go down as Barry's best rendition. We'll see what Thursday has to offer. And I love this tweet from Nick Ames saying, on missing football, I enjoyed the guy in Sainsbury's just now who hissed an urgent man on to his partner as I tried to safely edge past them. Might just be starting to miss football.
Good man, Nick.
Okay, so today we will try and get Barry to explain what's happening in Scotland. We'll look back at the life of Peter Bonetti. We'll bring you the latest on Premier League clubs and wage deferrals. There is Chapter 4 of Detective Wilson. But in just a second, Barney Ronay and Jonathan Wilson will join us to look back on Italy-Brazil from Spain 82. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. And let's bring in our panelists today. Jonathan Wilson, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
And Barney Ronay, first time on a lockdown pod. How are you, Barney?
Yeah, I'm fine, thanks. It's great to be able to see all four of you in sinister pixelated form while I'm speaking.
Shall we start then, looking at this game, Italy 3, Brazil 2 from Spain 82. Declan says, I was almost 7 years old when I watched this live. It feels like it must have been a Saturday, one of those pivotal childhood football memories. The colour, the goals, the drama, the exotic names. Wilson, you're already shaking your head. It wasn't a Saturday. You've already worked out what day that was, haven't you?
Yeah, no, I remember coming home from school to watch it, and I remember my dad coming in from work sort of, you know, towards the end of the game, so it wasn't a Saturday.
Why would you have been at school on the 5th of July?
Because that's when schools are in. Like, I don't know what schools you went to, but schools are...
Well, Barry went to an exclusive boarding school. So for him, he would have probably broken up in late May or something like that. It's a kind of different life.
6 weeks holiday run from the end of July to beginning of September normally.
Oh, well, in Ireland, we get 8 weeks holiday in national
school. In Ireland.
And I wasn't in a posh boarding school then, Barney. I was only 9 years old. Unlike you British people, us Irish people who get sent to posh boarding school don't get sent when we're 3 years old, wearing a top hat.
Anyway, it was a Monday, everybody. Wilson, it was the fourth ever game you watched, is that correct?
No, it's the fourth game I remember watching. So the first, I clearly must have watched other games, but the first game I remember watching was the 82 Cup Final. Then the cup final replay, although because I was a midweek evening, I wasn't allowed to sit up for the end of it. I think I must have gone to bed at half time or something. And then I remember England France from the group stages quite clearly. And then for some reason, I think we must have gone to Scotland for like a week, because I was definitely in Scotland when they went out to the Soviets. And I remember I was walking down the high street in Fort William, and I saw Trevor Francis score against Czechoslovakia through a TV shop window. I realise I've been on these lockdown ones twice now, and both times I've referred to seeing goals through TV shop windows. So, yeah, maybe that's just what happened in the 70s and 80s, that everybody spent all their time watching through TV shop windows. But I was definitely back at home for this. The problem is, I clearly have seen highlights of this repeatedly since. I watched the whole game again in 2008. I don't know what the real memory of it is and what has sort of been implanted by subsequent viewings of it.
Apparently your 2008 rewatch is a good story.
I mean, that's a little generous. Basically, Rob Smythe and I had this idea that Serginho, the sort of bumbling number nine, who sort of was widely sort of scapegoated for Brazil not winning that World Cup. Yeah, they had all these brilliant creative midfielders, Socrates and Zico and Falcao and everybody, and their centre forward was a sort of weird sort of British style target man. And so Rob Smythe and I thought, well, let's actually watch this and see if he was as bad as we said, or see if we can kind of do something to rehabilitate Serginho. And so Rob Smythe, this was back in 2008, so it was before all these games were available on YouTube. So the only way we could get them was Smythe somehow knew a Romanian dealer in Toronto who would send you DVDs of games. And so we got Brazil vs. the Soviet Union from the group stage and then this game, and we watched them at Smythe's flat in Bow. And the Soviet Union game is remarkable because it takes place, while it's taking place, the ceasefire is declared in the Falklands. So suddenly, midway through the first half, because this is just like the BBC, I think the ITV coverage, the commentator, whoever it is, sort of says, important breaking news, we're going to have to go for a news flash. And then there's a newsreader just sitting there with a bit of paper, reading out this statement saying that the war in the Falklands is over. And then they cut back to the studio before they go back to the commentary. And I think it's Brian Moore presenting, but I might be wrong about that. But there's three panellists, one of whom is Laurie McMenemy, who, of course, was a former guardsman. And whoever the presenter is turns to him and goes, Laurie, you're a former guardsman. What do you make of that? And Laurie McMenemy goes, well, obviously, it's great news for all the lads out there. And so Laurie McMenemy was, as far as I can tell, the first person on British TV to offer a comment on the end of the Falkland War.
That's quite interesting. We had an idea for a column a while back about, because you get news from the most ridiculous places, don't you? I remember I heard news of Nelson Mandela dying from a Pakistani cricket feed that I was following. You get your news from where have you got the world's most seismic events in the most sort of unlikely places. I think that would be number one contender for the start of this process.
Back to this actual football match. Barney, you wrote a column about we've all been asked to do our favourite game and you picked this game. Why did you pick this game?
It's interesting. I mean, it was interesting what you said in the introduction. I don't mean to disagree with your first five words on the pod, but one of the reasons people do remember this game, one of the things that really sticks is, like you said, that it's quite a sort of old person thing to say. But there were the colours and the sounds were completely unlike anything you'd really seen at that time. And this is probably quite a boring thing to say if you're under the age of 30, but it really was very, very different. And I think that's the first sort of thing that really struck you. Hi, Barry.
Sorry, no, I was making a signal to Max. You carry on.
What signal?
That I want to say something after you've finished.
For the listener, okay. for the listener, we have a plan on the Google Hangout that you raise your hand when you want to interject, so I don't just keep on babbling. But
Barney's just thought I was waving at him.
like someone's parent on Zoom going, isn't this clever? Anyway, Barney, do carry on.
Sorry. Anyway, it was nice. I enjoyed it. There are two reasons why this game really stuck with me, I guess. The first is kind of personal, in that I had a strong family connection to Brazil. My dad lived in Brazil at this time, and I had the full Brazil kit and Brazil tracksuit. And for a while, actually, my nickname was Brazil, because I wore all these shirts with Brazil written on them. And when I played football, I wanted to be Brazil, and I supported Brazil. And actually, I remember the first time I went to Brazil, one of the first things that really struck me was driving through Sao Paulo and seeing a man standing at a bus stop, middle-aged man with a moustache, wearing leather brogues and a full Brazil kit with socks and everything, with his briefcase, waiting to go to work. And this was totally normal. People loved that team. And it was this same kit, you know, it was the same colours and very short satiny shorts, and he was just off to work. And so I was a sort of Brazil fan, and they always had this kind of special resonance for me. And then I guess sort of more broadly, we'd not really seen people who looked like that or a scene like that, so intense, so they looked incredibly old and incredibly serious, and as though they're engaged in something really beyond football. The faces of the players as that game wore on were extraordinary. There was something to do with the direction. There were a lot of extreme close-ups as well. It was like a Sergio Leone film. It was really incredibly striking. I guess one of the other reasons I really remember this game is it seems to mark the departure between, or be one of many points that mark the departure between old and new. In that, when you watch that game, the styling, even the shirts, what the players look like, their physicality, they're very thin people. They look old-fashioned, whereas you fast forward just a couple of World Cups and everything has become new. Within 12 years of this, Brazil would go on to win the World Cup with a team that was totally different to this team. It was just a cutting edge with a load of incredibly canny, smart, physical footballers behind it, whereas this team was all fantasy, loosely stitched midfield and four or five number 10s and no cutting edge at all, and a load of blokes who looked like they stepped out of the 1970s. And so when you look back at it, it's incredibly intense, but it clearly comes from another world, both sort of tactically and in terms of its styling, what it felt like. And that, I guess, is why it sticks.
I think as well, it's important to remember that all bar two of the Brazil squad played their football in Brazil. So unlike today, where we kind of know most of the foreign footballers and most of them play in Europe, no one had ever seen these guys really before. We were unfamiliar with them. And then they arrived playing this amazing attacking football with these four or five midfield geniuses. They scored 10 goals in 3 games in the first group stage. Just to put it in context, this was the second group stage. Brazil needed to draw to go through, whereas Italy needed the win. But I think the sense of unfamiliarity with these players was added to the mystique.
The context of the game as well is that Italy was so unfancied in this game.
Yeah, that Brazil, they'd put 4 past New Zealand, 4 past Scotland, 2 past the Soviets. They'd beaten Argentina in the first game in the second group phase, and what was also a brilliant game. They just sort of seemed unstoppable. Whereas Italy had, they were coming off the back of the Todanero betting scandal. Paolo Rossi was coming back from a ban of his own. Looked totally out of sorts. They'd drawn all 3 games in the group stage. They only qualified from the group stage ahead of Cameroon on the basis of goals scored. They'd improved against Argentina, who they'd beaten 2-1, so the goal difference was against them. But they just didn't look like a team who could potentially go on. Brazil were massive, massive favourites.
Can we talk about Paolo Rossi? I mean, he scored a hat-trick. He took his goals well, all pretty avoidable, I'd say, from a Brazil perspective. Was he the greatest centre-forward on the planet at this time? Was he anywhere near that?
Not really. He'd only played a handful of games for Italy. I mean, he played at the 78 World Cup. I think he got 3 goals in 78. But then, he'd had this ban, so he just sort of hadn't been playing. Obviously, Italy rated him, or they wouldn't have picked him, particularly after the ban. But I think the rest of the world was sort of a little bit sceptical of him. And he'd shown nothing in the first 4 games to suggest he was going to score 6 goals in the last 3 games. But suddenly, he catches fire in that match, and it all takes off.
I think it sort of goes back in a way to what Barry said, and the genius of Rossi is that you know, these moments came around every 4 years where suddenly everyone's watching. And it really wasn't like that in between. And Rossi just seized that moment in time. And we're talking about him now. It wasn't like there'd be another global stage the following year or in 6 months' time or a Champions League final. This was his moment. And he, you know, he was described as playing like a ghost in the first group stage. He wasn't fit. He'd wandered through the group games. He hadn't been playing. And people wanted him to be dropped. So he literally had this game to sort of seize his own destiny in both hands. And he did it. And it's unrepeatable. And that was the sort of beauty of a World Cup in those days, in that it was chaotic. But if you did it, you did it. And that was it. That was your moment of history.
What was Rossi banned for? He was coming back off a ban?
Well, he was involved to some degree and at some extreme in a match-fixing scandal, which had kind of rocked Italian football. And so he'd been out and he hadn't been playing, he hadn't been fit, but he'd come back. And it's all part of the brilliant narrative of this game, the kind of redemption of it. I mean, football's a great thing. You can redeem yourself simply by succeeding.
I think there was a feeling in Italy that he'd been scapegoated, though, that, you know, they needed somebody to ban and he was the one that the finger fell upon. Yeah, he. There were others equally guilty who kind of got away with it.
No doubt that's true.
Italy won and won the World Cup, but the Brazilian team has the individuals that we still remember, you know, Eder, Falcao, Zico, Socrates. I mean, Socrates, to me, just watching that game, having never seen it before, looked like the best player on the pitch by a mile. I mean, he sort of felt a bit like Zidane in his control to me.
Yeah, that's a really good comparison. Because he's physically unusual in the same way as Zidane was, although a much, much skinnier version. And his control of the ball is just complete. And his genius is bringing other players in. It's often the touch that brings a pass that brings another touch. And the goal where he scored, the move with Zico, is it really stands out even in that game where there was a lot of sort of fine, neat, skillful players. And football's a bit different in those days. I think another reason, because when you look at the game now, you realise that football's really changed. It's not a thrill a minute. There's not incredible attacking play going on constantly. Quite a lot of the game is quite tough. There are long down periods where people are defending really well and it's really tight and nobody can really get the ball moving. You're just probing vaguely. And I think football has become a little bit, the rule changes have made it a little bit more carefree. You'll see bad defending. You'll see teams attacking, counter-attacking constantly now. Whereas moments like the moments that Socrates produced often did come out of absolutely nothing. And part of the thrill of Maradona's goal at the next World Cup was that literally came from nowhere. And you were just absolutely knocked sideways by it. And the moments that Socrates produces in that game are similar to that when you watch it back.
Jamie says, watching it now, see how the chalk comes up when Socrates scores. Such a shame that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, and of course, the other time when that sort of famously happened is in the last game of the 1950 World Cup, the Uruguayan winner, which is from a very similar position to the Socrates goal, sort of, you know, it's a narrow angle to the right. And the, you know, there's a puff of chalk dust goes up. So these two great traumas of Brazilian football, I guess you add in the semi-final in 2014 now. But you know, of the three great traumas of Brazilian football, the first two of them, you have this sort of this puff of chalk dust, so almost like the cordite from the assassin's gun.
Is it fair to say that the Italians targeted Zico, Barney?
Yeah, rightfully so. I mean, he was one of the best players in the world. He's the perfect number 10, a sort of an old school number 10, and he'd drop into often quite a similar space, quite deep behind the front man, and try and turn and spin and play passes and then run on. And he was just an absolute sort of dream of a player. But Gentile fouled him 7 times in that game. Often the same foul, just coming straight through him from behind as he looked to turn. Really quite brutal fouls. At one point, he also, as you see on the tape, literally rips his shirt. And you can see there's also a kind of nail, raked nails on his skin underneath it. The one moment when Zico got away from him, he created the goal we're talking about for Socrates with a brilliant little pass that took out 3 defenders. So you can see why Gentile was doing it. He's a brilliant player and pretty much kicked to the edge of this game.
This point you make about how games in those days turned on moments of individual brilliance. I think Errigo Sacchi is really interesting in this because, you know, Sacchi at this time is just starting to come through in Italy. and you know, he becomes Parma coach, which you know his first sort of major job. And the thing he talks about is how the thing he could never get his head around was in Italy they spent millions and millions of or billions and billions of lira on these you know great players, and then they just looked at the opposition and said, how do we stop them? They never thought about what they could do with their own players. And he said the whole change of his football when he, you know, when he got to Milan and he wins the league in 87-8 and then the two European Cups was trying to get Italian footballers to focus on themselves and what they could do rather than stopping the opposition. And rather than games being these incredibly sort of tight defensive games decided by you know the one little break, the one moment of brilliance, to try and convince all 10 new outfield players they are protagonists and at any moment yeah, they can do something to turn the game.
More importantly, though, Dino Zoff didn't take his own goal kicks, and which is brilliant Sunday league in you know in the world's biggest stage. This message from Mark, I really liked it. I've only ever played 4 Sunday league level games, all at right back, and making my debut at 36 years of age last year. In the last game, I was left to take a goal kick. It was the single most nerve-wracking thing I did. Thankfully, I hit it well and got it well clear, but damn, he says, what? I mean, Dino Zoff, I thought actually his handling was great in that game, and he came out very quickly to stop Serginho in one, but...
Well, the save he makes from Oscar later on is brilliant.
But why wasn't he taking goal kicks?
He was 40 years old, I presume, that you know, his hips had stopped working. And... I mean, this is the 80s. People age. You know, we were talking last time I was on about how people age differently. 40 years old, he probably had plastic hips, just kind of wouldn't have got the edge of the box.
Interesting thing about goalkeepers is how exhausting goal kicks are. If you take 12 goal kicks in a game as well as doing... By the 80th minute, I remember a goalkeeper telling me it's absolutely exhausting. And yeah, Zoff doesn't look particularly healthy. He doesn't look like... He's not a young 40-odd-year-old. But back to the point about Serginho. I'm still concerned, still confused why you chose Serginho as this cause. I mean, it never struck me as any kind of injustice. In Brazil, he was, they said famously before the World Cup, when Serginho plays, the ball is square. You know, he was not seen as a great under, I know he scored, domestically scored goals, but he wasn't seen as a great underrated talent.
Well, he wouldn't have played if Correa had been fit, right? So, I mean, he was a second choice anyway.
Well, that's not necessarily true. Correa had only played 4 games and hadn't scored for Brazil yet. But he was 20.
Okay.
He was 22 and he was injured before this tournament. And so they had this Roberto Dinamite as came in as his replacement, but he was never going to play.
And then Paulo Isidoro came on for Serginho in this game.
Yeah, but he wasn't a proper striker.
He wasn't out and out forward.
But, I mean, 86 era Correa in that 82 team would have been an absolute game changer. And I'm certain they would have won this game and the World Cup because he was a brilliant finisher. But Serginho was he just didn't fit in this team. They you know, he genuinely wasn't cut from the same cloth. He did score in the World Cup, but, you know, he missed 3 good chances in this game.
He scored 2 in this tournament and created 2. But could it be argued, and I agree he didn't seem to suit what the system they were playing, and just as sort of as a caveat, people thought it was this great improvised free-flowing football, but apparently Brazil had been cloistered together for 4 months, carefully rehearsing their improvised flamboyance.
That's the Brazilian way. They've always been ahead. They were seen as this kind of bunch of foundlings, or you know, they've all wandered out of the rainforest together, but totally not true. They were miles ahead in sports science, coaching camps, going right back to the 50s. You know, Brazil has often been quite the opposite of what you'd imagine. So they always did this as a matter of course. But when Socrates has spoken about this team, he said we didn't have a great structure in the team tactically.
Well, in 1970, they went on a NASA training course before the World Cup. Yeah, they got the training schedule that NASA had for astronauts, and they put the players on that. 1958, famously, they got a dentist in because they realised dental health was actually kind of a massive problem for them, and the dentist found pretty much every player had cavities and needed teeth out. So their preparation certainly from the mid 50s onwards has always been absolutely top class.
At the end of that 58 final, famously, the first person Pelé hugged was the team psychologist, who was a slightly crankish guy who did lots of kind of sort of weird kind of Rorschach tests and stuff on them. He was on the pitch celebrating with the players. And the English, you know, thought this was madness, lunacy. But, they were pretty advanced in all that stuff.
We were talking after the 73 Cup final about quite how old Bob Stokoe looked for someone who was in his early 40s. Bergamy, says Phil, has to be the oldest looking 18-year-old in the world. He did look about 48, didn't he, with a massive moustache. I want to talk about the kits a bit. Barney, we were watching this on a Google Hangout last night, and you talked quite evocatively about the sweat patches, not just on Rossi, but just on all the players, the Brazilians getting sweatier as they were clinging to try to get back in the game.
Yeah, sweat patches were quite a big part of this game. Rossi's sweat patch is amazing because it forms a love heart across his chest, which nobody else's sweat patch does. And it looks beautiful. And I'd love to have a shirt. People should make Italy shirts of that era with a heart-shaped patch across the front. I would wear it every day.
I loved the pitch markings as well, kind of horizontal stripes and diagonal in the corners. The goal nets are beautiful. So much loo roll on the pitch. I mean, it was a different time when loo roll was, you know, easy to come by, wasn't it? Do you think, because we were talking after the game, whether this really was a fantastic game of football or not, or whether it just, you know, there's a danger in looking back on any game and it not being what you remember it to be, Barney?
I think it's the fact that football was a bit, I think everything was a bit different before the modern age. I mean, I just think, if you think about it, so many forms of public entertainment have become a little bit... football has definitely become more exciting in terms of more stuff happens. There were long periods in games of football up until, I'd say, the early, mid-90s, where not much would happen. It was pretty grim. There'd be a lot of wrestling and tussling and people being fouled and people passing sideways. And players weren't as fit was part of that. So these moments would appear quite out of the blue, and that was one of the reasons they were so shocking. I think the Brazilian goals are really good. I mean, Falcao's goal was sensational, yeah, and not something you were quite really used to seeing. The way they controlled the ball, the touches, they were quite shocking at the time. I think we're maybe more used to this now.
About the Falcao goal, I was reading something yesterday, because when he wheeled away to celebrate, it looked as if he was, you know, so overcome that he was choking to death, because his face went bright red. And apparently he was choking, because in all the excitement of scoring, he had a big wad of chewing gum in his mouth and it got stuck in his windpipe, so he couldn't actually breathe properly.
Oh, my dad would always be so critical of Glenn Hoddle for chewing gum. He was saying it was medically very dangerous to chew gum while playing football.
Well, I remember watching a game years ago at home. It would have been a Chelsea game. Kerry Dixon was playing, and my mother was absolutely appalled by how often he spat. And that I think that's her only ever comment on a football match. But he's spitting an awful lot. That's filthy. And she warned me that if I ever became a professional footballer and she saw me spitting on television, I'd get a thick ear. So that's probably what stopped me becoming a top-flight footballer.
And what better way to finish looking back on Italy 3, Brazil 2 in Spain 82 than Kerry Dixon gobbing all over a football pitch? And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll talk about all the latest football news. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Southampton's squad have agreed to go without 10% of their pay for the next 3 months to ensure non-playing staff receive their salaries in full. Ralph Hasenhüttl, senior coaching staff and board of directors, are all deferring some of their pay for the next 3 months. Brighton are in discussions with their squad over a wage cut, with a view to returning the money if the season starts in front of fans rather than behind closed doors. Man City are understood to be in talks over wage deferrals. West Ham are hoping players would accept a proposal to defer 30% of their wages. David Moyes has taken that cut. The club intend to raise at least $30 million through a rights issue next month. Karen Brady's taken 30% pay cut as well to ensure that full-time and casual staff continue to be paid in full. There is this issue about the clubs having to pay back Sky and BT around $420 million plus more to international broadcasters if the season doesn't finish, because they were paid up front. Sky and BT, by all accounts, don't want a dispute and are trying to work with this. Barney, you find all of this discussion sort of quite tiring.
No, I mean, I wouldn't say that. I mean, it's good that people are doing things and trying to retain staff by cutting their wages. But I have to say, I find the whole discussion about this, I find it very, very hard to be interested in it. I feel like we're talking about this because football has an enormous attached media, which examines its every, unlike any other industry. So it becomes centre stage. You know, we could have, Martians attack the planet, and football's reaction to it would be an incredibly important thing, just because there are people standing there watching football the whole time. We have to have a view. It's a very small part of the economy in reality, and a very small part of life. But it's, as ever, hogging the headlines. If we had a huge attached embedded media following around the financial industry, we'd all be talking about that instead. But as it is, it's football, which is, it's important to be a role model suddenly and to lead the way. I mean, I suppose the one thing it has, all this has revealed, is it sort of held a mirror up to just how absurd a lot of the industry is, just how much everybody dislikes and distrusts each other, and just how sort of venal some of it is, which is interesting. But I do think we should probably stop commentating on what football is doing in response to an entirely un-football crisis, which affects people in far more important ways than what football is doing.
Gamma says, apparently Norwich have signed a player. How the hell have they done that? Yeah, they've agreed to sign Luxembourg forward Daniel Sinani ahead of the 2020-21 campaign, whenever that is. He's signed a pre-contract agreement from Luxembourg side Dudelang. Barry, I saw you engaged on social media with some Norwich fans about this. The timing seems curious.
Well, someone raised the issue on Twitter that, you know, how dare Norwich sign new players when they're furloughing staff? And the fact of the matter is, it's not a great look, but if you scratch beneath the surface, they actually agreed to sign this guy in January. They're only announcing it now. I'm not sure why that is. He is coming in on a free, so it's not like they've just signed Cristiano Ronaldo. But he will presumably be taking a hefty wage. He may have got a signing on fee. It's not a big deal in the cosmic scheme of things. My argument was, when asked by some Norwich fan, you know, why is it a bad look, or what was wrong with making the announcement now, it was just that it was bad PR. But like I say, I've never heard of this guy. He coming in a free, and he was signed in January, and he won't be joining the club for another few months or whenever we get going again. So I don't think it's a particularly big deal, but it's not a great look.
IFAB have released their laws of the game document, hooray, which is, I suppose we've all got time, haven't we? It's a record of the current laws of football with some adjustments from last season, which are encouraging referees to use their pitch side monitors, especially to review incidents which are deemed subjective. Handball will now be judged when the ball strikes a player below the armpit, which I think would mean the nearly Wilson scenario that happened in Burnley-Bournemouth would have stood as a goal for Bournemouth, so becoming 1-1 instead of 2-0, if you remember back that far to when football actually happened. And goalkeepers will only be penalised for coming off their line before a penalty is struck if they save it. So there we go. There are some rules. Wilson, how do you feel about the new Wilson scenario?
I mean, below the armpit doesn't seem tremendously helpful as a phrase. I presume there's some sort of some accompanying diagram. The problem is, if you lift your hand above your head, then what's below the armpit becomes above the armpit. So I think that phrasing is perhaps unhelpful. But it's a good thing that they've seen that there is an issue that people don't know where the hand starts, and they've at least begun this the process of clarifying that. So I think IFAB generally are quite a good thing. And it's literally the only thing that Britain still controls in the world. So let's get behind our brave boys.
Where does this leave us on shoulders? Because there was this existential issue about football struggling with do shoulders exist or not?
I think they do exist. Jonathan's had plenty of surgery to suggest if they don't exist, he's wasted quite a lot of time.
I'm still on the anti-inflammatories.
Hey, really? How's the sling? What was it called again?
Oh, I can't remember.
It had quite a name.
Something 3. No, sorry, it was an Ultrasling 2, but apparently there was an Ultrasling 3, which had an extra band.
Producer Jonathan sounded so sad when part of his brain is taking up with remembering the name of your various slings. Richard's been in touch to say, assuming Barry will have some stuff to fill Fitbar Corner with. Take it away, Barry.
Oh, Richard, what are you doing to me, mate? I was trying to make head and tail of what's going on in Scotland this morning. And it's basically a big, like a cartoon fight. It's just a big cloud of dust. with various fists and boots sticking out of it and exclamations of pain. The Scottish Professional Football League put it to a vote of all the Scottish Professional League clubs. Should they curtail the season so that they could award £9 million in prize money to all the various clubs, who many of whom are in dire financial need of a cash injection. So what would happen would be this prize money would be distributed amongst the clubs. There would be nobody would be crowned champions, but teams in the current relegation positions would be relegated. They all voted, and basically what's happened is Dundee in the Championship have what amounts to a casting vote. They cast their vote on, I think it was Friday, and then immediately sent word to the Scottish Professional Football League that their vote was not to be considered. They didn't want it to count, and they were going to vote again, basically. And they haven't voted since. They haven't commented on the situation since. So basically, you have all these teams in Scotland waiting for Dundee to cast a vote, which will more or less decide what happens in Scotland this year, this season. In the meantime, Rangers have kicked off accusing the Scottish Professional Football League of corruption. They say they have evidence of some sort of malfeasance, which they will only put before an independent inquiry. And Hearts, who in the current circumstances would be relegated from the Scottish Premiership and lose £4 or 5 million in income next season on the back of that, they're also kicking off. It's horrifically complicated. It may well move on before this pod even sees the light of day. So I'm going to stop talking about it now. But suffice to say, it is a chaotic mess in Scotland. And are we really surprised?
I'd like Barry to give some more historic background. and also, perhaps Barry could explain why Dundee have the casting vote on all this. And why Dundee have voted and then said that they haven't voted and then not re-voted. What's wrong with Dundee? Where did Dundee get off acting like that?
Well, I think Dundee have got notions above their station because they're based in the city where Alan Partridge famously drove in his bare feet while eating a Toblerone and having a mental breakdown. Dundee, everyone has voted except Dundee, and there's 10 clubs in the Scottish Championship. 8 of them have to vote yes for this scheme to be passed, and Dundee had originally voted no, but now they've decided they didn't want their vote to count, so they need to vote again. There's no actual deadline to this, so it'll be... I was about to say it'll be interesting to see what happens. It won't, but I just want it to end so that I don't ever have to talk about it again.
Thank you, Barry. Sad news over the weekend. Peter Benetti died aged 78 after a long illness. He had 15 years at Chelsea. He made 729 appearances, second only to Ron Harris. He had 7 England caps, mainly a backup to Gordon Banks. He was part of the 66 squad. He received his winner's medal in 2009 after the FA campaigned for non-playing members of the squad to be recognised. Obviously, very well known as the Cat, only 5'10". Wilson, he will be remembered largely, and perhaps unfairly, when you judge a whole man's career over that day in 1970 when Gordon Banks had food poisoning and England were 2-0 up and lost 3-2 to West Germany.
Yeah, and there's the Franz Beckenbauer goal, which begins that comeback. You know, it sort of bubbles through him, and unfortunately, that is, you know, the thing that the population at large will remember. But you know, he was a spectacularly good goalkeeper. You know, you see clips of Chelsea games and. Yeah, he was phenomenally agile, incredibly gymnastic, which is, you know, why he got the nickname. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who I don't think he's particularly sort of interested in football. He's much more of a cricket man, and he grew up in Leeds in the 70s, and he remembers that, you know, if somebody playing in goal in the playground made a great save, he'd be referred to as a Benetti. So yeah, his name was associated with these spectacular saves, and yeah, he was a brilliant goalkeeper. But for the presence of Gordon Banks, you're one of the all-time great goalkeepers, he would have won more than those 7 England caps.
The funny thing about that game you mentioned I'm sure everyone's heard this story, but it just made me laugh. I asked Gordon Banks about that game once. Obviously, he missed it because he was ill the game against Germany. And he was actually watching the game from his hotel bed. He was not feeling really queasy, so he fell asleep with England leading. Woke up when two of the players came into his room after the game. And he was like, oh, lads, brilliant. And they had these somber faces on and were really upset. And for several minutes, he thought they were joking. He thought it was a prank on him that they'd lost the game. He said, oh, come on, lads, you know, what's this all about? Why are you so down? And they say, no, we lost. And they had to actually get the manager in to explain to Banks that we did actually lose the game, Gordon, which is extraordinary if you think about now. Clued up everyone is on anything.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Amazing man, Gordon Banks. Lovely man.
Good news that Kenny Dalglish has been released from hospital after a couple of days in there after testing positive for the coronavirus. Wilson, you have important intel on this.
Well, I just saw a story this morning that apparently when Alan Shearer and Terry McDermott rang him up to sort of wish him well, he sort of got rid of them very quickly because he was trying to watch Vera. So Kenny Dalglish is a big fan of Vera, which is great news.
Do you recommend? I've never started Vera. Is this a hole in my...
Yeah, I mean, look, I accept that I'm sympathetic towards it because it's set in the Northeast. You see a lot of the places that I went to growing up and that I know. I think it starts slowly. I think season one is not the best. I think it's one of those slightly odd series where, when they were based on the novels, they didn't work as well as when they were written specifically for TV. So I think Anne Cleves, who wrote it, character obviously works brilliantly, and that dynamic in the office works brilliantly, but maybe the plotting isn't as great for TV as it becomes. So I think it's only really sort of season two, season three when it kicks into gear. Season one, I found a little bit, but you know, I love it.
For the benefit of any of our international listeners who may not be familiar with Vera, it's a detective's drama, basically. I started watching it last week. Is Brenda Blethyn actually a Geordie?
No, and her accent definitely improves as the series go by and she gets used to it. The accent early on is kind of wobbles all over the place. There's a mate of mine's sister played a non-speaking desk sergeant in several series, getting 80 quid a day, unless she had to drive a Land Rover, in which case she got 100 quid a day.
Good to know. Anyway, that's enough for now. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Barney.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Total pleasure. Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Thanks.
We'll leave you with chapter 4 of Detective Wilson. You had the choice of whether you wanted the chapter Head to Webster's Alone or Dip into the Loan Market. And 72.1% of you voted for the Loan Market. So here is chapter 4 of Detective Wilson. If you remember, Sam Diss has been found dead at Roots Hall and Detective Wilson has been framed for his murder, but he has a few days to try and solve the case on his own. After Barney's warning, Wilson had given Flo the slip and headed to Webster's bar solo, knowing that he couldn't do this alone. He made some calls. At the top of his transfer list was the silver-tongued lawyer, Philippe Auclair. Salut, you've reached the phone of Philippe. I'm afraid I'm not available right now, but leave your message and I'll get back to you tout de suite. Au revoir. Wilson found it disconcerting. Philippe always took his calls. With the Frenchman on the bench now, he'd have to settle for someone from the lower leagues. He dialed another number. An hour later, he walked through the doors of Mark Webster's Den of Depravity. The last time he was here was about 10 years ago, and today was exactly the same. Just like Tony Pulis, this place never evolved. John Wilson came a friendly Welsh brogue, his new signing already waiting for him at the bar, Ellis James, private investigator. Wilson suspected that they were going to have to get their hands dirty, and Ellis was the perfect man for the job. "To what do I owe this pleasure, me old mucker?" the PI asked, raising his glass. With no time for pleasantries, Wilson went straight in. "The Mundial kid is dead, Ellis, and someone's trying to frame me. I've just given Flo and the FWPD the slip, but now I'm playing lone striker. I need some backup from someone who knows this league well. I need your help." Ellis was ashen-faced. "Bloody hell, I can see why you wanted to meet here." He knocked back his whiskey. "Sam was here shortly before he died," Wilson replied. The Welshman sighed. "So, I'm already on the clock then, am I? Groovy." He laid out his plans to Ellis. "I'm going to get Webster out of his office. You need to slip in and check the ledger on his desk. That will tell you when Sam was last in. Check CCTV around that time and see who he was meeting." "You don't ask for much, do you, John?" smiled Ellis. "Let's do it." Wilson called to the barman. "Is Mark here?" The young man shrugged. "Who's asking?" Cut the shit, son. Go tell him it's an old friend from his days with the FWPD. Now, how are you, man? The young man nodded sheepishly, heading towards Webster's office and went inside. Haven't lost your touch, I see, said Ellis, before marking the office door, ready to nip in unsuspected. Webster emerged, scanning the room. When he spotted Wilson, he gave a big toothy grin and headed over, blissfully unaware of the gangly Welshman that had just penetrated his back line and slipped into his office. As I live and breathe, said Mark in his gravelly drawl, if it ain't old Detective Wilson gracing my gaff once more. Wilson got straight to it. Hello, Mark. Know why I'm here? Webster smiled. To see an old friend, I would assume. He put two fingers up to the barman to signal two drinks. Don't play dumb, Mark. It doesn't suit you, Wilson replied. At that moment, the barman walked over and placed the drinks down. Webster raised his glass. To good health. Taking a sip, he lowered his voice. This isn't anything to do with a certain young lad's rather unpleasant trip to Roots Hall now, is it? Bingo. I know Sam was one of your customers, Mark. Be a shame if the press got hold of that bit of info when the story breaks, said Wilson. Webster laughed. I don't know why you ever got out of this game. You clearly still love running the channels. He gave Wilson a wink and then continued. Yeah, the kid came in every now and again. So what? Any idea who he was meeting? The detective asked. Wilson detected a flicker of worry in Webster's eyes and pounced on it. What is it, Mark? Tell me. The gangster sighed. In the past few weeks, we've had a few people coming in here and asking for him. Wilson pressed on. Who? Anyone you know? Webster shook his head. Nah, they claim to be Mundy Isle fans, but they didn't look like no fans to me. They looked like trouble. Anything else? Said Wilson. Just one thing. Webster finished his drink and leaned forward. They felt proper dangerous, John. Like Revy's Leeds or the Crazy Gang. They just had that look about them. If you're going to drop into this league, you best be prepared for some agricultural tackles, if you know what I mean. Wilson nodded. He knew all too well. Good, said Webster. Now get out of here before people start questioning my character. Wilson stood up and headed outside. Ellis was waiting for him. Did you find him on the CCTV, he asked. Bloody right I did. And you'll never guess who he was having a pint with. Ellis pulled out his phone and hit play. A grainy video showed Sam sitting at a table alone. A waitress walked over with a tray of five drinks. Bloody hell, is he having a party? Asked Wilson. Just wait. You'll love this next bit. Ellis fast-forwarded a couple of minutes and then hit play just as Sam got up to shake hands with a well-dressed man accompanied by three others. Wilson knew them all immediately and smiled to himself. This was proving to be a very intriguing case. What had Sam stumbled onto? Who wanted him kept quiet? And why did he have a meeting with the boys from the football ramble just before he died? Chapter 5. Does Wilson investigate the world of Mundy Isle or head for an afternoon ramble? You decide. We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.